I'm Jay Edidin.
And I'm Miles Stokes.
And we are here to explain the X-Men.
Because it's about time someone did.
Welcome to episode 303 of Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men, where we walk you through the ins, the outs, and the retcons of comics' greatest superhero soap opera. And today, the significantly more complicated, somehow, ethics of consuming and covering them.
This is going to be a pretty non-standard episode. Normally we talk about continuity, or at least non-continuity things like movies. Today's going to be about where the industry is right now, where it's been, and how we interact with it. Jay, you could probably put this better than me.
Right. So as those of you who follow comics news in the comics industry have seen, there's been a lot of recent conversation about abuse and harassment within the comics industry and power dynamics around that. That conversation's been ongoing for a much longer time, but it's had a flare recently and has had a few on an ongoing basis. And we realized as we were looking at that and as we were looking at our upcoming coverage coming out of the Age of Apocalypse that we're coming into an era that's largely defined by two writers who've come up a lot in those conversations. For a long time, Scott Lobdell, and more recently, Warren Ellis. And so we felt like before we jumped back into that continuity fully, we wanted to take an episode to really talk about the kind of complex and largely gray ethics of covering and consuming works connected to people we feel ethically iffy about supporting. With us for that conversation, I'm really, really happy to welcome writer, editor, critic, my former boss, actually, Laura Hudson. Laura, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm actually really excited about this conversation. I don't know if excited is the right word, but I am happy to be here.
We are going to try to have as much fun with this decidedly not even remotely fun topic as is possible to do. So we'll see how it goes.
I should say going in, by the way, that this is not a podcast that you're going to come out of with a clear, this is what I should do. This is the right thing to do. This is the way to retain my ethical high ground answer. This is basically going to be a conversation about the questions that we ask and how we address them, because this is, as we're going to cover, complex, nuanced, and in a lot of ways, subjective territory. Not you know, whether it's okay to harass and abuse people, that we're real solid on, that's it's not. But again, the larger conversation about that, how it ties into works and how it ties into how we approach conversations around those works.
So Laura, I first became familiar with your work when you were running Comics Alliance back in the day. Still probably the best comics journalism site ever, I'm going to say. But can you tell the listeners a bit more about what you're up to these days?
These days, after spending about 11 years in Portland with a year out when I was a senior editor at Wired, I am actually down in Los Angeles doing some work in television and a little bit on the side in video games. So I'm sort of on the creative side of things, fingers crossed, at least for the moment.
We're going to touch more back on that in a little bit. And also, I will say, if you click through to the visual companion of this episode at explainthexmen.com, you'll find links to where you can find Laura's work and look her up online. Yeah, and if you are hiring writers, you should hire her because she's awesome.
Oh, thank you, Jay. I'm glad that you brought that up about this not being a podcast that's going to offer a single answer, because, you know, I agree. I don't think that's possible, because I don't think there's just one question, so there can't possibly be one answer. I think there are so many different ways to come at it, whether they're personal or professional or happening in any number of different contexts, about any number of different contexts. And I think that's what makes it so complicated for people, and part of what drives this desire for there to be a simple answer, for there to be a clean answer, so that people know that they're doing the right thing. And I think while that's a noble impulse, I don't know that that's always possible.
Yeah. And I think, especially like what we've been doing with this podcast, as we've been historically covering, you know, everything within a certain publishing line, you know, it would be much more straightforward if we could just say, hey, anything by these creators, editors, artists, whatever, who have done some very bad things in their lives, we're just not going to cover. But that I think does a disservice to the larger X universe that we're trying to discuss, the other creators who have worked on those books. And that's not to say that, you know, we would advise other people to handle things in the way we do, not at all. But that's certainly something, Jay, that you and I have discussed a number of times.
I think it's a set of questions that applies in different ways depending on the larger context. For me, it's more an issue of the fact that those people are and have been part of the conversation already, whether we want that or not. And part of what we cover on this part of podcast, part of what we do, is talk about the creative and cultural context that these comics came out of and the roles they played in shaping that. And I don't think you can ethically cover that and not look at this stuff and not look at this era and not look at the evolution of the standards that we apply to creators, you know, in context of what was taken as givens before.
Yeah, I mean, I think even if you look at this outside of the lens of harassment, if you think about it in terms of problematic media, I think if you, even if you get out, you know, as few as 5-10 years from now, you're going to be running into, let alone now, sorry, you're going to be running into a lot of material that either subtly or overtly expresses, you know, sexism, if not low-key racism. I mean, these were a lot of the cultural contexts from which these stories were coming. And I think it's important to be able to recognize these problematic elements, to acknowledge them. But I don't think that that means that they necessarily need to be excised. And I actually think superhero comics occupies an interesting space that I think reflects a larger issue around this stuff, which is that as a shared universe, it is really difficult to excise particular parts of it, right? Because everything's connected. And I think that's often true with creators in media in ways that, you know, we don't always acknowledge. You know, it's you know, we tend to privilege writers in comics or, you know, directors in film or, you know, lead actors as the most visible element of a piece of media. And if they turn out to be a piece of shit and we excise that, we're also excising the work of all of the people around them who worked on that project, because it's almost never a singular product of one person. That's not me saying that people shouldn't make their own decisions, you know, whether they're abstractly moral or personal in a visceral way. All of those reasons are valid reasons. But I think that those decisions become complicated because there are not neat lines that you can cut around when it comes to people who have done bad things or even expressed really problematic things in their work. It's all kind of bound together with so much else.
An issue that what you discussed brings up for me, you were talking about problematic content within fictional work, which is something that we've addressed a lot within the show. For me, there's part of the issue, and part of the issue, I think, in the larger discussions about things like diversity and representation in comics, is how that translates when we're talking about actual people. Because, you know, I can read a comic from read old X-Men comics and be like, holy shit, this is amazingly sexist. And not really feeling like the fact that I'm buying those comics, that I'm you know, buying print editions of them, is contributing to that. But if I buy a comic where I've got a fairly clear idea that the creators are going to be getting royalties or where the sales figures are going to be affecting the careers of a living creator, that feels like a different set of standards, or like it calls for a different set of standards.
Yeah, that's something I've certainly thought about as well. I think that the creator that jumps to mind for me is not even a comics creator at all, but Orson Scott Card. Like, he wrote a video game that came out a few years ago called Shadow Complex. It looked really good. I struggled with how to handle that because that was after it had become very clear what his views on homosexuality, among other things, were. And I don't know. I mean, I've heard some people suggesting the idea of you buy the media, but then you make an equal contribution to a good and relevant cause that creator would hate, but you know is a good thing, or you just try to buy media used, or I don't know. There's no real easy answer there, I think.
Yeah, I think a lot of the personal consumption thing is a personal specific line. There are And it's a line that I'm so much more comfortable drawing for myself as a consumer than I am for drawing for myself as a critic or drawing for anyone else. Like, I can say easily, I do not purchase works where this person is credited unless I'm buying them used. Or I do not purchase works from this publisher unless I'm buying them used, or things like that. But those are like, those feel like personal lines. Like, I don't think that those decisions are moving the market significantly. And I don't expect, and I'd urge anyone, by the way, who does draw those lines for those reasons and wants it to be known, to actually write to publishers and tell them that if you're doing that, that's a way to give those more impact. But again, that feels personal.
Yeah. I feel like I feel like my perspective is kind of warped in so many ways, because I've spent so much of my adult life as a critic, where so much of what I have consumed, sort of by necessity, has often had very little to do with what I wanted. You know, I think particularly this is true if you're on a beat, and you're on a beat in a way where you need to be somewhat comprehensive. You don't necessarily get to opt out of major parts of that landscape, either because you personally don't enjoy it, or, you know, you have a problem with one of the creators that's involved because your consumption of it doesn't necessarily relate to, again, your desire to support this person. It relates to the fact that you have to be cognizant of all of these things in order to potentially do the type of criticism and the type of analysis that you want to do, and that I think might potentially shed light on it in a meaningful way. Or at least those are the things that I say to myself. Jay, I don't know how it is for you.
I mean, a lot of it is that this is all, for me, all of this also falls under the larger umbrella of no ethical consumption under capitalism.
Yeah.
No matter where I spend dollars that I spend on media, there is no, I have had to and have chosen to, and working, like you said, working as a critic and also working in creative and publishing capacities in comics, like, my name is in books that I would prefer my name not be in. And there are places where I've been able to draw that line. There are places where I haven't. And some of that is the nature of the job. Some of that is the nature of the job in ways that tie very much to larger discussions about labor within comics and the lack of options and you know, the basic economic coercion that exists as a default in an industry where people are usually living hand to mouth. But if anything, what that sort of left me with is a sense that this is really complex, and I don't have a single right answer. But at the same time, you know, and we talked about this a bunch in the Wired days, around coverage, around angles, around discussing, you know, larger social issues in context of reviews and in context of, like, even just private use of social platforms. But one of the questions Miles and I come up with a lot here is that this isn't just our consumption. Like, how we what we discuss and how we discuss it is whether or not we make strict, explicit recommendations, whether or not we give ourselves that layer of plausible deniability. We need to take into account that we're discussing work in a way and in a context that encourages people to consume it.
Do you feel that that's true as you work your way through the canon, even if you were, for example, deeply critical of a particular book, arc, era?
I mean, I think our personal coverage style can make that be the case, simply because, like, if we really, really like a story, it's very easy to just talk in these hushed tones, or in my case, elevated tones, about how great it is. Like, oh, it's the Dark Phoenix saga, it's God Loves, Man Kills, it's the Brood saga, whatever. But when it comes to work we don't like, and whether that's work we don't like just because we think it's bad, or work we don't like because, you know, we have an ethical problem with what it's describing, or at times perhaps some of the people behind it, we tend to get very snarky with those episodes, which I think can sometimes make people want to see what we're making all these jokes about. And so I don't know. Like, we don't want to come up with a boring episode if we don't like the work. And so I almost wonder if we're feeding into that a bit.
Well, also, I think we're thorough. Like, we tend to try to even if our recommendation is ultimately don't read this, it's pointless, we'll generally talk a fair lot about why. And something that, I mean, one of the things that I'm coming up against here is that I'll say outright, while I am generally not wildly fond of his writing, there's a lot in Scott Lobdell's X-Men run, for instance, that is really personally resonant for me and that I think is defining in terms of characterization and approach in ways that are significant to the continuity and significant to the larger shape of comics. He's also the writer who you see adapting the X-Men comics as the movies are coming out, which is, again, something that I, as a critic and as an academic and as a theorist, I want to cover, and I'm gravitating towards wanting to cover. But there are also just, I mean, whether or not we're recommending things, there are people who read along with the podcast. We're sequentially covering a large body of work in weekly chunks, and just the nature and the shape of it means that to some extent it's going to shape the consumption of the consumption habits of the audience.
Yeah, I mean, as someone who spent many years reviewing Batman Odyssey with David Wolkin, and ended up helping sell many, many, many copies of that comic, there's less of moral judgment here. So, you know, so much as what we've done to just people's minds. But yeah, like many people have come up to me and told me that they bought the comic because of that, and I don't know if I should say you're welcome or I'm sorry. But yeah, I mean, it's when you're making those types of jokes, you create, when you're doing that type of engagement, I totally get that you're creating a desire for the person to see the thing that you're seeing, you know, in the same way that if you were Mystery Science Theater 3000-ing a terrible movie, I could see someone being like, yeah, I kind of want to see the movie now, even if it's a piece of shit. Going back to what you were saying about Lobdell, I noticed that the episode number is 303, which kind of struck me because Lobdell wrote Uncanny X-Men 303, which was the issue where Jean Grey comforts Jubilee after the death of Ilyana. It had like the almost all white cover. I remember this vividly off the top of my head because I read that comic at a young age and it had a huge impact on me in the way that I thought about loss. At a time when I really hadn't experienced very much and was sort of trying to wrap my brain around it. And it was one of those things where even when I sold off a lot of my single issues, it was something that I kept for years and years. A lot of his work was really formative for me. And, you know, that was certainly a strange part of becoming a comic book critic, becoming someone who would meet these people, is dealing with them as human beings is so much more complicated. And it also touches on something else that I've thought about and been asked about when it comes to this sort of stuff, where it's like, I still have that issue. Do I throw it away? Because I've certainly seen people say, you know, when a particular creator is Me Too'd, where they're like, I threw all of his trades away today. And you know what? If that is the thing that feels right to you, I think that that's totally valid. But I don't think that that is the only appropriate moral response. I think it becomes that question of, especially if you've already bought it, right? You already have it. It still means something to you. You know, can you take that from it? Can you continue to take that from it while still recognizing and acknowledging these problems around the artist? And I think a lot of the time, the answer for me is yes. But again, your mileage may vary.
I think a big question, a question that it's really important to ask yourself when you're considering, you know, you talked about throwing away back issues and trades. And that's something that's always struck me as something that it's fine to do if you know what you want to get out of it. If what you're shooting for is catharsis, that's a great way to achieve that. And that's a perfectly reasonable thing to shoot for. If what you're shooting for is not having those books in your house anymore in the most efficient and expedient way possible, again, that achieves that pretty quickly. It achieves it more quickly than things like figuring out somewhere to donate them. If what you are shooting for is something that's going to have impact outside of you going forward, I think it's a gesture that, I mean, I think it's a gesture that is valid as a personal gesture, and can, if it means something to you, great, do it. Coming from a publishing and media standpoint, I don't think that it's something that has the impact that people think that it has, in terms of public perception and in terms of especially perception of the folks controlling the purse strings.
Yeah, if you're going to do it for yourself.
Yeah.
Because that's really the only person it's going to affect at that point. You know, I think as some people who follow along on Twitter might remember from last fall, I spoke up about a sort of Me Too incident involving myself and Brian Wood. And, you know, and in part because of previous incidents that had happened with the same creator. And, you know, I got a lot of support from people in general and from followers, and people were, I mean, really awesome about it on the whole. But I did have a lot of people saying, like, you know, I'm throwing away his books now. And I was kind of like, if that's what you want to do, then you do that for you, but you don't need, and this is only speaking for myself, but you don't need to do that for me. Like, I still like Demo. I also think it's, you know, another layer to this, which I bring up because I think it's a really good example of how many layers of complexity this can have, how not neat the lines of the map are on here. You know, that incident is part of what ended up bringing my writing and my resume to the attention of Ava DuVernay, which ended up resulting in me getting a staff writer position on the DMZ television show. DMZ, as most of you may know, being a comic book that Brian Wood wrote. So if you want to, you know, if people feel the need to throw out their DMZ trades, then, you know, again, I think that's a very personal choice. But, you know, I'm also someone who's now personally involved with an adaptation of the work. And I think that's a particularly complicated illustration of it, but I think it often is that complicated.
And to respond to that, yeah, that's something that I think about with a lot of these works. Like, we talk about Lobdell or Ellis or Wood or any of this sadly large number of creators who are not so hot as far as the how to treat other people skills. But especially in the comics industry, certainly in film or video games or almost any type of media subgenre, you're going to see so many people involved in any given work. It's not just a writer writing a comic. It's also, and it's not even just the penciler. It's the inker, the colorist, the letterer, the editor, the person who's doing marketing or accounting at that company or whatever. And so it seems unfortunate sometimes, both in general, that, you know, we'll have these central figures in media properties who are seen as the sole creator, but certainly in a situation like this, that adds complexity as well.
I think another aspect to this, and to this specific situation, the DMZ show, that really changes the paradigm of it is looking at it from a community justice angle, because this isn't just taking this thing by or primarily associated with someone and you know, giving it more traction. It's using it as a vehicle to center people and voices and perspectives who were at least somewhat silenced or marginalized by the original behavior of the writer behind this thing. And I think that's a really powerful shift, and I think it's a really important shift. Obviously, I think it's something that depends a lot on the creation, on the property in question, on the approach to it, on the media around it. But and this is one of those larger, I wish we had time to just spend about a year and a half, maybe, on this, because I think this is a larger question that speaks more to the responsibility of people in positions of creative and financial control in entertainment and publishing, but using those properties as a reparative vehicle is something that I think is worth examining and worth considering. So I guess, you know, the question is, can you do that as a critic? Who gets to claim that? Who gets to say, okay, this is a thing that has these issues attached to it, but we are now taking it and saying that discussion of it is about elevating a different set of voices.
I mean, I think it's I'm trying to think about this editorially, like how to set that up structurally, right? You know, I think one thing that you see a lot of critics do, for example, is sort of essentially stamping it with a caveat, right? Where they're like, mm-hmm. Well, if I have to bring up this person who's a harasser or an abuser, I'm going to say it every time, yeah. You know, I'm going to make sure that that's clear. But to your point, Jay, is that still centering that person? What would it look like within a critical context for that to be transformative? I don't have an answer, by the way. I just think it's an interesting question.
I don't either. I just wanted people to discuss it. That's I'm going to ask a lot of questions that are just things I agonize about when I can't sleep at 4 a.m.
Well, so, and it's like,
you know, what this episode is.
It's, you know, I lose perspective sometimes because so many of the people that I know are creators of one type or another. And I feel like I'm thinking out loud as I go. So let's find out if I'm wrong. You know, I think in a way it's potentially easier for that to be transformative if the person who was most affected was a creator, right? Because then you can center on their work. You can elevate their work. You know, you can be like, well, look at their art. It's amazing. Look at their writing. Let's, again, as you said, give this person who was, you know, silenced or marginalized or dehumanized, let's put the focus back where it belongs, where the person who mistreated them, in fact, did not put it, which is on their work. I think it's more complicated, for example, if the person, you know, just like, I don't know, is like an administrative assistant, like how I'm not sure what centering that would necessarily look like in a critical context beyond. And you all, when someone's not a public figure, they may also not want to be centered.
Yeah, that's a really good point as well. I mean, because in discussing, like, I don't feel guilty about discussing, you know, the wrongdoings of a creator who has done wrong. But in terms of how much that brings the discussion to the person who has been wronged, that's gonna vary hugely depending on the circumstance.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we can do as people who are making media and talking about media is encourage listeners and people who are reading these who do have questions about the ethics of consuming these things to look for conversations that center the voices of folks who've been impacted by them. And that's easier to do with some creators than others. I think, at this point, it's worth saying we're going to have a number of links in the visual companion to this. All of those come with a fairly intense content warning as far as discussions of issues of harassment and abuse and grooming, but they're going to be there both as things that are you know informative to the ways that we think about these and specific to some of the creators who we're going to be covering or have been covering or talk to here. And I think the one of the most comprehensive and organized efforts around that is obviously the so many of us.com, which was put together by 60 women and non-binary people who Warren Ellis had targeted over years and years. And which has the distinction of, which not only centers those voices, but has the distinction of having very, very specific goals and requests attached to it. So I would urge anyone who's asking those questions around Ellis specifically to look there.
Do you mean goals and questions in terms of what they're representing or what they want to see happen?
In terms of what the people who are coming forward with stories are asking of the people who are reading those stories and reevaluating their relationships with media or with a creator based on it.
Oh, that's really interesting. I'm like, now I want to go read that. I'm also kind of curious about both of your thoughts. You know, because I feel like a lot of this is sort of touching on the idea of restorative justice. You know, I'm someone who has Let's lightly say I have a lot of concerns about, for example, the use of the criminal justice system as a punitive tool, as opposed to addressing harm in a way that is designed to minimize that harm or, again, restore victims. And I'm kind of curious what your thoughts are on what that looks like in the context of an artist and their potential role within a community moving forward.
That is a really, really hard question.
Yeah.
And certainly something we've Jay and I have talked about and I've thought about, but I do think the internet has a tendency to make, and this seems to be like one of the themes that we're just coming back to again and again in this episode, to make things seem simple. There's certainly a human desire to make the world make sense, to make complicated ethical scenarios less so, where you can look at something and say, okay, I'm handling this in the ethical correct way. I am making this judgment, which is a straightforward judgment, to condemn or forgive a given person. And I think when it comes to exactly what you're describing, Laura, just that potential for restorative justice, I worry that if that is something that's possible for certain creators, I think for some it would be, for some it would not be, or around their creations, I worry that it's easy to use the same brush to paint all of them, to either be too lenient in our evaluations or to have condemnation thorough enough that we don't find a way to fix these problems. Instead, we just sweep them under the rug because we have decided that someone just needs to be gone. And I do think that there are some people who do just need to be gone, but
yeah.
I don't know. It just seems like there's all of this gray out there, and finding a more permanent solution to this and figuring out, you know, what do we do in terms of creators who have done harm that really requires just more of that grayness, I guess.
I think, I mean, what I come back to every time I try to address this in terms of progress and what we actually need to do, is that I follow it all the way down the thread to dismantling patriarchy and capitalism.
Fuck yeah.
Because ultimately, because that sounds facile, but I feel like ultimately that's the thing that we need to do to be able to have this conversation really effectively. That said, I tend to come at this with the caveat that there is no, again, 100% right approach. I tend to come down hard on the side of harm reduction. Mm. And I'm going to quote song lyrics here because I am classy like that. No,
I don't want to miss a thing by Aerosmith because I've heard that. Like,
it is not, and it's also not going to be Every Rose Has Its Thorn because this is not that kind of a time travel story. But no, it's a song called Lord of the Rings by the Double Clicks, and one of it's got a bridge in the second half of it that's just a repetition of the lines. I don't care if you are happy now. I just hope that you are victimless. And. Mm. So I feel like that's a pretty powerful point. The other thing that I think is incredibly important is to decenter perpetrators in this conversation.
That's a really good point.
We can talk until we are blue in the face about whether and how to rehabilitate individuals who cross lines. Where I think we need to be focusing first and centrally as a community are the people who have disappeared or been silenced as a result of those crossed lines, which again is why I think what you talked about on DMZ is a model worth exploring and looking at and discussing, because it again changes the way voices are centered and visibility is centered. But one of the things, I'm going to go back to Alice again. I said I wasn't going to focus on single examples, but I think this is a powerful one because one of the things that you see repeatedly if you read through the stories on so many of us is people who entered into what they thought was a professional mentorship and whose professional options and career were shifted or derailed as a result of what Ellis did and the ways that he used that. And I think if I were in a position, you know, for example, of significant hiring power, if I were working somewhere like Vertigo, which has played a huge role in Ellis's ongoing visibility in the comics community, the question I would be asking isn't, can we work with Warren Ellis again? It would be, how many of these people have we overlooked because someone who was more visible pushed them aside? And how can we rectify that? And how can we make this a place where they're safe and comfortable working and where we can actually cultivate the careers that were promised that?
I think there's also this element of, what's the word that I want to use? Mythology around some creators. And I think this extends beyond comics, but certainly exists within it, where I think whether it's a gut response or one that people acknowledge on the surface, there's this idea that, you know, sort of too much will be lost if we just cut out Warren Ellis or if we just cut out so-and-so. And that's not to say that these people haven't created great and meaningful work in general and, you know, within the fabric of comics. But the thing I feel like people don't necessarily talk about in the same way is because you can't, because it's hard to talk about a negative space, is the people you've never seen, the great works you've never seen from the people who were driven away. It's something I've thought a lot about. You know, I got involved in video games after comics, which is, you know, frying pan into the fire, woohoo! And just in time for Gamergate, I saw so many women and non-binary people driven out of that sphere by just the most horrible forms of harassment. And Jay, I think this goes back to your point about dismantling patriarchy. Is, you know, even if we want to get bigger about this, it is bigger than just the most horrific incidents of assault and harassment, right? It's also about the larger fabric of these systems that in ways both small and large drive people away, make them unwelcome, undermine them, convince them that they have no chance of success, and sometimes ensure that that's true.
Yeah, I mean, it's looking at systems that prioritize, say, an Eddie Braganza over and over and over over again, explicitly over women who, for instance, are shunted into non-creative paths because they're not comfortable working under him.
And it's a self-reinforcing system, because the more you have these problematic people in these central roles pushing out people who, perhaps if they had more power, could help shift those dynamics, the more it happens, and the more it happens, and the more it happens.
I sometimes don't understand how it doesn't jump out to people more. You know, I think they sometimes look, and I think you can say this more broadly about all different types of work, you know, like, let's say film, for example. Do you, you know, think that I'm pulling this number out of my ass, someone, it's probably slightly different, but, you know, are 90-95% of men film directors? Are they the most acclaimed film directors because men are just better at it? Like, how, if you realize that that's not true, how do you not look at those numbers and say, and just mourn on some level for the perspective, like the masterworks, the genius of the non-cis white dudes who have been obliterated from this space? You know, because we can recognize that Warren Ellis has made some really great stuff, but I think that if you get too deep into mourning that, you forget about the things you don't even know how to mourn, and you don't necessarily recognize that if we do this right, if we open up these spaces, there are going to be other great works that we can't even with a breadth and a depth that we can't even imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I can't answer the how can you not mourn that question, because mourning that has been so much of the backbeat of the last decade of my life. Like, I feel like that's something that once you've seen it, it's really impossible to unsee, and it's really unethical to unsee or to try to. My my thought experiment answer, my trying to figure out how this stuff happens, how to have conversations about it that are useful on an organizational level, I think is largely that people want to be good people. And they want to think they're good people. And they want to think that their desire to be good people matters more than it actually does in terms of impact. And ultimately, you know, for every Eddie Braganza, there's going to be someone who was willing to excuse his actions because they related to him just enough to be willing to project their own good intentions. Or there's going to be someone who covered and shifted things because they had so well internalized the idea that scandal is harm in yeah. ways that people quietly leading isn't. And some of it is just that if you are working in that system, longevity in that system, I think, is tied pretty directly to ability to tolerate that shit. And ability to tolerate it is to some extent often tied to ability to internalize it and convince yourself that this is the system working.
And speaking as somebody who works for a comics publisher and has for many years, that's one of the reasons I'm so grateful for all of the people who have been so brave enough to speak out both recently and over the last many, many years, because those voices have become loud enough and ubiquitous enough that those in power at those publishers can't just ignore it anymore. They can't just convince themselves that, oh, it's actually fine, this isn't a big deal, because it's just become so glaringly clear to everybody who doesn't have their eyes and ears completely closed that, no, things are not okay, and things have not really ever been okay. And so I'm hopeful that maybe we are at a turning point of some sort, that maybe we will start having an environment that is less hostile to people who are not white cis men. Maybe that's me being naively optimistic. I don't know, but it really does feel like things are maybe starting to get to a point where they can change.
I mean, I think a lot of the power to create that change is concentrated really high up in individual companies in places and ways that worry me. On the other hand, and I should plug, by the way, that this is the second night in a row that I'm recording a podcast about this. Last night I was talking to Alana Levin and other really, really amazing guests on graphic policy about this sort of from a more industry and structural perspective. But I think ultimately the thing that's got to happen for sea change in the way that we're seeing it because of the way that power is concentrated in the comics industry is twofold. One is labor organization, and what form that's going to take is going to be variable. I think I am solidly with Joan Hilty, who says that there's the idea that there should be one comics union is not really a reasonable one. If nothing else, like the difference between publishing what publishing employees would need as a collective bargaining unit versus what freelance creators would is enough that those should be separate entities. But there's larger, yeah, you know, there are larger scales and other models for that. So I think labor organization is one of them, and to create structures for collective bargaining and collective speech that change the power dynamics enough that people speaking up about harassment and abuse aren't committing career suicide. Second is getting major structural policy changes, which can happen some from that collective bargaining, but need to happen because people in positions of significant power, you know, C-suite employees at smaller companies, parent companies at larger publishers, decide that this needs to change. And ideally, they would decide that this needs to change because they look at things, they see things they didn't notice before, they go back, they make serious attempts to educate themselves, to, you know, really pursue community and reparative justice in this. Realistically, sometimes what it takes people to decide that something wants and needs to change is, for instance, significant financial pressure or significant guilt. So how we shift those folks to that position is something that I'm less solid in terms of tactics. I should say, you know, as someone who's both done investigative journalism about this and run direct public pressure campaigns, I think it's important. I think it's central, but it's something that again, I want to tie back to individual consumers and to critics and critical coverage of those and how we discuss them and sort of what's important and what I think the takeaways are here. And I think the biggest one for me is to keep discussing it, that we should be linking to those stories. And we haven't done this. And I want to start in every episode where we talk about those creators' work, that there shouldn't necessarily be a line or a separation when it's something that significant, or if until we're at a point. But yeah, but I don't know if that is the answer, because that implies that there is one blanket situation, and there's not.
Well, and I think that's where it just comes down to exactly what you just said. We keep talking about it because the more we talk about it, the better we understand what works and what doesn't, and where we are as individuals in as part of this process.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this is what, Jay, if this is what you meant by blanket situation, but another, and again, I don't have an answer to this, just saying that up front. I think another complicated thing that comes up is when you are talking about, well, what's happened? You know, and I think that's difficult because you don't want to minimize any kind of harm or any kind of mistreatment. Right. At the same time, you know, for example, a violent assault is different from maybe other subtler kinds of harassment. And I find it difficult to figure out how to grapple with without, you know, I don't want to minimize anything. But when I consider the reformability of the artist in question, again, like, have they actually committed a crime? I think that violent crimes really are a different category. I think it's difficult to parse degree, even though sometimes degrees do matter, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it's something where I feel like it's our responsibility to bring it up and to address it. I don't feel like it's our responsibility, and I don't feel like it is responsible of us to adjudicate it.
I guess my question would be, would you have to determine a threshold at which this something would become mentionable as opposed to not?
I don't know. And I don't know that there's a single... I don't know that there's a single right answer on that one. Like, I think this is something, it's, again, much easier for me to look at structurally and from a prevention angle, because there I can be like, we need to do this, we need to do that, we need to do this other thing. But I don't know. And I don't know that I have a single consistent threshold for that, which is weird to realize and examine, and I think important too.
It's weird, but we, in a sense, right? But we also started off this conversation by talking about how, again, we don't have anything prescriptive to offer people. There's no flow chart that I can write out for people that they can follow down to, you know, the correct thing to do in a particular situation, because, you know, even anything you'd put in a particular box, you know, for harassment or harassment at a particular company or harassment involving a particular person or the individual circumstances of that type of harassment and the, you know, the chronic nature of the, you know, there's so many different variables. And again, like, I don't ever want to pit one survivor or one set of circumstances against the other, but the totality of a set of circumstances and its context, I feel like that's kind of the only way to make decisions. And it doesn't lend itself to flowcharts or rules. And it also means that you have to make a complicated, challenging, bespoke decision every time. And yeah. And that's it. It's work. It's
and
work
risk and being wrong in that decision, which I think is a necessary risk to any kind of public conversation.
I do think that's the subtext for a lot of the questions that people ask, and they're not wrong for doing so, but mm-hmm. I think people are very afraid about being wrong on this in one way or another. And I can't comfort them, because you should be, you know, mm-hmm. like, that doesn't mean that your history's greatest villain if you get something wrong, it means that
it depends on what you get wrong.
Okay, that's true. That's true. I'm thinking in my mind, I'm thinking more about like throw it out the comic or don't throw out the comic. But you're right.
There okay, yeah. Genocide is good. Actually, is a stance that we're not gonna. Yeah.
Right. Right. We
draw the line specifically at hunting humans for sport. If you are zombie Marsha P. Johnson, we are in favor of that. Otherwise, don't.
I think people should be afraid of being wrong, but I think all you can really do is do your best, center survivors, and be willing to admit when you've gotten it wrong.
Yeah. I think the fear of being wrong, I mean, I'd love to get to a point culturally where the fear of being wrong comes more from genuine fear of doing inadvertent harm than it comes from fear of consequences.
I was thinking about that earlier, Jay, when you were saying something about people want to be good.
Yeah.
And I don't want to sound too critical of people here because it's good to want to be good, right? But I also think it's important to ask yourself, who are you being good for? And I mean in the sense of like, be good to people in life, but I'm like, do you want to be good because you want to feel good about yourself? Because you want to be absolved and you want to feel like you're an okay person? Or do you want to be good when you're making these decisions because you truly want to do right by other people? Because I think sometimes it can be a mix of the two. And I think that if you really try and refocus yourself on the latter, on I want to be good because I want to be good for other people. I want harm reduction. I want restorative justice. I want to be good because I want to make things better for other people. I think it gets a lot clearer than if you're consciously or subconsciously focused on I want to be good so that I know that I'm pure, that I'm absolved, that I'm a good guy.
That my instincts are the correct ones unexamined.
Because that's really because of you. And I don't think that that is likely to lead you to the right conclusion.
Yeah, I think so. I think the other big takeaway there, and I think what's been a big takeaway in this conversation on an ongoing basis, as people have re-examined things like close relationships and professional things, is that there not being a single right answer also means that there are a lot of wrong answers.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of different kinds of wrong answers. And some of it is subjectivity, and some of it is realizations after the fact. And some of it is the fact that we are figuring this stuff out as we go along. And by we and this stuff, I mean, to a large extent, people having public conversations about it or private conversations about it, and this stuff being the ethics of being human in a complicated capitalist and largely inequitable culture. And to do that well and to do that ethically, I mean, I am anticipating, and we're going to be keeping a close eye on the comments and moderating them there, but I'm anticipating a lot of disagreement there, and I'm really looking forward to it, because one of the things that I really count on in this context, in those platforms, and that I try to seek before making things public, but also really hope that if there's a takeaway that people have gotten from the ways that we discuss art and creators on the podcast, it's that being challenged and having your assumptions challenged and challenging other people's assumptions are necessary and healthy, and are how you learn to see things outside of your line of vision and frame of reference and identify those. So mm-hmm. I can say, you know, we will keep trying and listening as we do this, but there's, yeah, we would, and we're going to also probably, now, actually, we do have a thing we can consistently link back to from other episodes, I guess. We have the space, but we should wrap up now. We are about out of time. Laura, thank you so much for coming in here and examining impossible open-ended questions with us.
No, I actually love this conversation, and I really appreciated the approach to it. Because again, I think this is a topic about which a lot of people are tempted to speak with a lot of prescriptiveness and a lot of certitude. And I think it's a much more I think it's a much more humane and a much more realistic approach to say that it's complicated. It's not simple. You may screw up. But
I'm going to go ahead and be prescriptive there and say you will screw up. You will at some point do inadvertent harm through your notice or lack of notice of something. And there are ethical absolutes in how you handle that, but it will happen at some point in your life.
It will happen at some point. And to your earlier point, being challenged on something, whether you are challenged by new information or a new situation or directly challenged by another person, it doesn't mean that you're history's greatest villain, but it does mean that you have a responsibility to learn. And you can.
Well said. And yeah, Laura, thank you so much for being here and for your sharing your experience and your insight. And if people want to find you online, where should they look?
Well, I'm on Twitter, twitter.com/ Laura, LAURA underscore Hudson, HUDSON. I spend probably too much time bullshitting on there. If you'd like to read some of my selected works from my time in journalism, you can go to laurahudson.me and enjoy.
And with that,
Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men is recorded in New Fairfield, Connecticut, in exile from Forest Hills, New York, and Portland, Oregon, and produced by Matt Hunter, who also arranged our theme music. You can find more of Matt's music at moon-talk.bandcamp.com.
New episodes of Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men come out most Sundays on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and at explainthexmen.com.
Check out explainthexmen.com for all kinds of extra content, including visual companions to every episode.
Our show is 100% listener-supported. If you'd like to help us stay on the air and ad-free, check out the Patreon link at the top of explainthexmen.com.
In 2 weeks, we're headed back into the comics and back to X-Force.
Just in time for Cannonball to leave for the X-Men.